Good morning, or good afternoon, depending on where you're joining us from. Welcome to the third webinar in the Multilingual TV Spring Series, where we'll be having a conversation on globalization for startups and the enterprise business. Scaling and running a company across the globe presents a number of operational, communication, and technological challenges, many of which can be overcome with smart decision-making and planning. My name is JP Mengelinden. I'm a technology journalist, and I am honored and excited to be hosting and moderating today's panel. Stay with us to the end, where we've dedicated 30 minutes to questions from the audience. Now, without further ado, on to our terrific group of panelists. We've gathered a very experienced group of executives from diverse backgrounds who can speak to the topic from firsthand experience. And it's my pleasure to introduce them. First, we have Kristen Giovannis, CEO of United Language Group, a complete language solution platform and one of the largest language service providers in the world. Kristen, if you could say a few words about yourself.
Thank you, JP, for the introduction. And hello, everyone. I'm excited to be here. As JP said, I'm the CEO of United Language Group, which is a language technology and solutions company that is a fairly has a fairly extensive global footprint. In fact, we're in 8 countries. And so I come here today with the lens of both a business leader who's expanded my own business globally, as well as a company that supports clients in their globalization journey. So I'm honored to be asked to participate in this panel, and I hope I'm able to provide both insights into the challenges and hopefully provide some valuable feedback as well. Thank you.
Thanks, Kristen. Next, we have Evandro Magalhaes, Chief Language Officer of Kudo, a multilingual web conferencing platform with human-powered simultaneous interpreting. Evandro, if you'd like to say a few words about yourself.
Well, thank you, JP. It's an honor to be here. I'm very happy to be sharing the stage with Kristen on and my co-founder, Fardad, and Evan as well. So it's a pleasure. As you said, I'm with Kudo. I'm the chief language officer. I'm an interpreter by training. I've been for the last 30 years. So it will be a pleasure to tackle the many questions that will come. Thank you.
Thanks, Evandro. We're also joined by Sean Tuzzi, CEO of Glow 3D 360, which creates 2D and 3D product photography for over 30,000 professionals. Sean, if you'd like to take a few moments to discuss yourself.
Thank you so much, JP, and hi, everyone. Sean Tuzzi, I'm CEO, co-founder of Glow 3D. We'll help any e-commerce platform to create interactive 2D and 3D photo of their products. We have offices in Toronto, and we have offices in Toronto, Canada, for ones that don't know, and Malaysia, and is happy to be here.
Thanks, Sean. And last but certainly not least, we have Fardad Sabishan, CEO and co-founder of Kudo. Fardad, would you like to say a few words about yourself?
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you, JP, and thanks for everybody joining us today. Fardad Sabishan, I am based in New York and happy to share the next hour with everybody, sharing some of my lessons learned of building and growing 3 companies with a global footprint. And hopefully this could be beneficial with our audience. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Fardad. Now let's talk about the trajectory of how businesses go global. How early in a company's lifespan should one think about global expansion? Is global an aspect you're thinking about from day one? Or do you think about, or do you approach global expansion only once you've established a solid reach domestically? Can you walk me through the thought planning processes of going global in your respective businesses? Fardad, maybe we could start with you.
Yes. So if you ask me, the answer is very solid yes from day one. And the reason is whether you are just starting designing a product, a new service, an idea, just having from very early on direct customers' feedback, diverse customers' feedback from global users would bring really an edge, a competitive edge to building that product, to really fine tune that service model business from early on. So you're going to become a lot more future proof for competitions, for customer acquisitions, as well as building a business that is sustainable and immune to various geopolitical situations that might happen down the line. So this, of course, is a lot more possible these days to start thinking about building a business from day one with a global vision. And definitely my approach is from day one.
Kristen, with your company, was that also the case? Did you also think about global expansion from day one? Or was that something that you thought about later on in the expansion process?
Early in my career, I started a company several years ago. I don't even want to think about how many years ago, that eventually became global. And, you know, I made the mistake of not thinking global right away. I thought domestic only and set up a company that was very domestic based, US centric. And so then when we attempted to go global, the first couple, you know, attempts into a market entry, both from an operational expansion as well as a market expansion opportunity, we were really challenged with things regarding technology, regarding communication, regarding even cultural awareness and cultural competencies within our own organization. And so I agree with Verdad. I think it's something that as soon as you think and you know your global is a plan, it's going to be part of your future strategy, it needs to be incorporated early into your thought process and being part of the larger plan.
Got it. And for you, Sean, with Glow3D, how did you approach global expansion? Was it on day one as Fardah did, or was it a bit later on as Kristen did?
I think that the idea of globalization is very much depends on the product and what kind of company you are. For example, for us, the way our product was, which is literally anybody that has a product online, selling product online, could use our software. Our limitation probably was just language, because our current setup is English, and we can see that people have issue with whether communicating with us in English, or they want the texts and the app that they're using for capture to be in a different language. But we could say that our product, the way it was set up, it could be global. But if you look at it comparing to different kind of, if somebody has in a restaurant, or my education is an architect, so if somebody's an architect, you can't really start a business thinking global. Even in technology, if you're an Uber, if you're an Etsy, if you're an Airbnb, obviously you could have a vision of someday become global, but your start must be local because you're a marketplace. You have to start, you know, from a smaller market, you know, build it, and then try to repeat the model in different countries. So answering to your question, JP, is that I think the product and what industry you are very much determines if you can be global, and if you can be global, when is the best time to really put the resource? Because obviously going global means spending money, having people, resources. But for my company, we very much thought of being global, and we're even trying to reach out to people in different other languages and trying to create partnerships to really resolve those concerns.
I'd love to unpack that a little further with all three of you. What barriers, both expected and unexpected, did you run into while expanding globally? And can you give concrete examples? Fardah, I'd love to circle back with you. What barriers did you run into?
So these barriers, they are kind of a market knowledge. I would start from there, you know, where to start, where do you want to really put your initial focus and resources? What market has the highest potential with the least amount of basically homework that you got to do to be able to approach that? So that's kind of a one, and I agree with Sean, it really depends on the product or service you offer. But really, taking the route with the highest impact, the highest potential, with the least amount of change and resources that you want to dedicate, and it's not easy to discover these opportunities. But as far as barriers, these barriers, they have really evolved or changed during, you know, years. But I would say today, one of our main barriers is really compliances, regulations, recruitment. We are a US-based company, and we have about 150 team members today. Out of these 150 team members, 50 of us are US-based, and 100 of us are basically global. And a great thing is that there has been a lot of technology companies and service companies in the past 2 years that really designed and really blossomed because of this remote work and being able to expand globally. So for us, we're looking at a lot of great solutions to be able to recruit team members outside, but kind of meeting the compliances and regulations in each country. But I think really understanding the market, understanding the culture, the how people they do business, that's one thing that it's about kind of overcoming and going there with full knowledge. But of course, language is another aspect of it. Being able to communicate with people and being able to have the tools to be understood, that's another thing, whether it's a written or verbal or basically communication, whether synchronous or asynchronous communication.
Yeah, and sorry, JP. No, I was just going to say, I agree with Ferdad that a big challenge, I think, is regulation and compliance. I think that continues to be a challenge for any company going global right now. And there's just, you know, a lot of use cases around that. And it's something to really be thoughtful about. I also think one of the challenges we had was understanding what really resonated in specific markets from a communication perspective, what was culturally relevant for positioning products, as well as what was important from a cultural perspective as we grew our operational piece as well. So understanding how to communicate with our employees who, even though English is our working language as an organization, we have, you know, 500 employees, everyone speaks English, understanding that hearing things and communicating to them in their language resulted in having better outcomes, having better KPIs, and aligning the company and figuring out how to do that in a way from a global culture that's still supported on a local level in language was really, I think, an important learning lesson for us.
Kristen, can you expound a little bit further? Because you, United Language Group offers like a number of services from translation to interpreting to localization. Is there maybe one example that comes to mind?
Yeah. So even with our clients, I think a lot of our clients think, you know, if you translate the content, you put it in the language, it's going to be good enough to be able to position and market. And in a lot of cases, especially around certain types of products, you have to think local specific. You know, how is it going to, your messaging going to resonate in that market? What's going to be the hook to be able to expand, you know, your product or your presence? And thinking more about transcreation, as well as making sure that you have language resources available to communicate more effectively with local stakeholders that are part of any deal that you may be pushing forward is very critical. And we've seen that break down in certain areas where we haven't maybe put the correct maybe focus. Our clients haven't in making sure they have those resources, as well as seeing the successes of bringing in language resources at the right point to ensure, you know, bringing something across the line and supporting the clients more appropriately. You know, in our company, we're doing everything from clinical trial support to technical, you know, products that are going into market. And it really does depend on the product and the company, but really having a thoughtful approach to the language piece of it and how you're both going to communicate and engage is really important.
Thanks, Kristen. And for you, Sean, Kristen touched upon it. You touched upon it as well. I realize expansion very much varies depending on the product and the products and the regions and countries you're expanding into. And Glow3D obviously has a number of products, plugins, and add-ons. And I was wondering if you could expand upon one or two instances or use cases in which things varied in terms of expansion.
Yes, for us, our biggest challenge for going global aside from the reach and understanding how some local businesses differ in terms of how they function and how they set up their staff, has been language. Language in interacting with our potential customers. That has been our biggest challenge so far. We are not a very large company, so we don't have that issue of a hierarchy in our system where it is important that employees and the staff would they understand each other or not. At the stage we're all basically there's no hierarchy. Like anybody can contact anybody in any level at any time, and we don't have that issue in terms of internal employee communication. But when we are reaching out to potential audience, potential customers, whether they are our customers in a sense that they are paying us to create content using our software, or they are users that are using the end product and they're asking questions how to navigate through photos. And I can give you a good example that we had working with a potential customer. And they were from Mexico, and we were all speaking English, and we really want to. I remember it was almost a year ago, and we didn't have any Spanish speaking staff in our team, and we had to remotely meet with them. We didn't want to lose the opportunity, and I remember what I did. I asked my wife, who's an architect, and says, "Hey, like this is the challenge we have. We have to communicate with this customer." And they specifically told us, they're not comfortable with English. Is it possible to do that in Spanish? And my wife had an employee, Lucy, was from Peru and was fluently speaking Spanish. And we really asked her to join us in that meeting as a person that would do the interpretation. And the challenge obviously with that comes that like somebody that is from a different industry, you have to educate them, tell them this is our software, so we might see these questions. So for us, really to Fardad's and Christian's points, communicating with potential prospects when you are from a country that, let's say it's either English or Spanish, and then you have to reach with somebody who's speaking French, that is also has been the biggest challenge for us so far. Obviously, regulations and so many other things may become important. For example, if you are a medical, you're creating a medical device, then regulations going through, FDA approval. If you're launching it in US, obviously we don't have those issues, those barriers. If you are, for example, a company like Uber, you have to get approval from transportations, your Airbnb, you have to get Ministry of Housings and Affairs in each country. Sometimes in each neighborhood, there are different regulations. But for us, the biggest challenge has been really the language, because we are not really that much limited with the regulations. It's really a platform to create content. And yes, the language, I think for us, based on the product and the stage we are, has been the biggest challenge.
Fardad, I want to circle back to you because Kudo has this terrific product. There's Kudo Marketplace, which to me seems like the first of its kind in which, I'm able to hold a conversation virtually with anyone, in which there are, multiple interpreters translating conversations in real time in multiple languages. And it is really such a paradigm shift, I think, in the way that one can hold business and personal conversations. Can you briefly walk me through the challenges you had to overcome to enable that kind of experience from a business perspective?
Absolutely. Happy to. So basically we're doing at Kudo is really providing a business tool for businesses to be able to reach to a much wider audience, whether they want to do a customer research, whether they want to launch a product, whether they're looking for partnership and discuss business opportunities with their potential strategic partner, or doing a due diligence, would be able to overcome that language barrier. And when you think about creating almost a 21st century version of the Silk Road, of being able to create a Silk Road, but in the cloud, to really connect businesses and opportunities. So of course, building a platform and having this very large network of interpreters, this has been a lot of investment of resources and time, and really making sure that we can scale and we can build our technology to be able to have hundreds of meetings or thousands of meetings at the same time, right? So this has been quite a challenge, knowing that we also have a global team, and we do have a lot of different languages being our first language in our business. So at Kudo itself, we have about 29 languages that are first language of our team members. And that's quite significant when you think about it. So, but everybody has that limited proficiency in English to be able to communicate internally, but also at the same time, some of our all hands meeting, we have live interpretation even for our internal meeting, which is really what we stand for, being able to provide the tools so people could be understood, could be heard, right?
Right, and it's absolutely, it's a great platform. We have talked so far about some of the several factors that have served as barriers to entry into various regions and countries around the world in terms of expansion, certainly localization, certainly compliance. What we haven't talked about so far are budgets and the pandemic, which I feel like I would be remiss in talking about, given how much it has impacted everyone around the world. But in terms of budgets, how important, I guess, how instrumental our budgets were and are for you in terms of global expansion? Maybe Kristen, if it sounds like you might want to weigh in. Yeah,
sure. No, I could jump in. I mean, budgets for, you know, both ourselves, but again, for our clients is critical. You know, there's only, you know, so much money in the bank, we like to say, even for our clients, and how they choose to utilize that and where they choose to invest is really important. As we've already said, certain content, let's say, and certain interpretation are just required. They're you know, regulated. Examples are like interpretation in healthcare, or translating content that's high tech and has a high liability where there's a regulated requirement. But there's also a lot of consumption of both content and opportunity to engage either your employees or your market that can be utilized through, you know, other resources and technology now that wasn't really as applicable maybe 10 years ago and certainly not 20 years ago, which are making things more affordable. So I think utilizing the right solutions and products where you can, the right AI and MT, and then the right touch points where it comes of live interpreters versus, you know, translators and editors versus a machine translation or a VRI or OPI that's done via AI is an important decision that you have to make as an organization, because there are ways to do and have reach and have impact with tech solutions that weren't readily available until I think the last couple of years.
Oh, Sean, would you like to weigh in?
I think in terms of budget, it very much depends on the stage and the startup is. And the smaller a company is, the less money you have, and you have to be more vigilant. And you have to really think more, more strategically on how you're going to spend it. The way I would at least see it, and my decision making in going global and advertising into new market, I would typically start with, as to Farhad's point, what is the lowest hanging fruit, right? What is the market that I can have the most impact, help my customers the most? And that's where I would start spending money. and whether it could be a vertical. So let's say, for example, automotive in the entire planet, or it could be a multi-vertical, but you know, just in local. Just let's say I will just deliver food in Toronto. And then, you know, if I was a food company, if I was an Uber, I'm bringing back to that. If I was, then I would service to all the people that need a taxi, I could replace them. For us, the budget probably is the highest barrier, because with globalization comes like you have to make your app, your product multi-language. Mm-hmm. And then that means you need a staff to software engineers to really deal with that. So I think I think for my startup, our globalization right now, even though that we don't want to lose anybody that is not English language, because our main focus is to go after English language countries. And obviously we welcome anybody that finds us, you know, by watching one of our YouTubes, and then they're interested, they want to learn more, they want to include the technology. We definitely go any extra way that we have to go. We even offer them partnerships. So to your point, JP, is budget is probably, for my stage of startups and probably for most of earliest stage of startup, would be the most limiting barrier. The other things I think is what I would say product market fit, right? So if you don't have the product market fit, and for some of the audience that may not know what that is in a world of startup, when you're starting something, a product, obviously you have an idea, you want to solve a problem, and there are so many variations of your product that could, you know, best fit your audience, your market. Sometimes you don't even know what is your exact audience. Doing variations, trying to test it with different potential customers, that's where the effort is in product market fit. And I think for any company to go to growing a stage with globalization would be a super important part of that. They should have meet their product market fit. They should have a product that they know is working perfectly, either across that a small geographic area or across, you know, that major vertical that they're focused on. So in my opinion, to go global, I think you need to have product market fit. And I think you do need to have the budget. These are probably two wings that would help you go global: money, budget, and having a product market fit.
And one thing, if I could just, oh, I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, Christine.
No, I was just going to say, if there's one thing I could just add to that, because I think that's exactly how I view it too, Sean. But I think one of the things that we see as a mistake that our clients we've seen make, and, you know, even to some extent as I've gone global things, you know, we've struggled with, is it's one thing to go global. It's another thing to stay and support global. And so to be able to get a product ready for global distribution is one thing. It's a huge undertaking. There's so many costs and factors to it. But then once that product is there, it's typically not products that are, you know, cash and carry. You're not walking out the door with the product and you're done with it. The experience isn't over. So how do you support market? How do you ensure to continue to have appropriate outreach and engagement with your client groups and continue to support, especially for tech platforms that are rapidly changing and you need to constantly be thinking about it. So I think when you think about budgets, some companies fail to think about the after. You know, you get it to market, but then what? And having a more thoughtful approach of how do you support post going to market is critical.
JP, if I may weigh in on this from a different angle. Whenever we talk about budgets, any over-focus on budget may very soon turn into cost-cutting, mm-hmm. which is also another threat that we have, because again, the pandemic is a good example. Sometimes the remedy kills the patient, right? Mm-hmm. Stay at home, don't go anywhere, and you end up not having anything to eat because you just can't. Again, you don't work and you don't get paid. So over-focusing on budgets to the extent that budgets are limited, and then putting a lot of stress on the vendors is a mistake. So we're reminded of this every day at Kudu, that no matter what we do, regardless of the level of disruption that we're bringing to the market, we have to continue to have our vendors in mind, because they are at the core of everything that we do, and they need to continue to make a living. So we have to be very mindful not to let any budgetary discussion devolve into a cost cutting and a race to the bottom in terms of the fees that eventually we need to pay to the people that actually keep us in business.
Right?
Yeah. I want to add something here, if I may. It goes back to Sean's point about product market fit and what's the right time to go global. By the way, also echo what Kristen mentioned. So when we say going global or expanding to global market, it's not necessarily when you start offering your services and selling your product to a global customer. It's a state of mind that needs to be in place from day one. Just going back to the example of product market fit. So if you're building a product with a global state of mind, you need to be already having that those conversations with global users to get to the point that you have the right product market fit, right? So it is very important to start those conversations before you're at the time that you want to launch a product. So how to design it, what are the customers' conversations that you want to have for, with your domestic customers and your global customers, while you're just in very early stage of usability, features, willingness to pay, the price conversation. So this is all at a very early stage. So the work needs to be started way in advance before you have the final solution to go global.
Thanks, Wardad. I appreciate that. We didn't talk about the pandemic. We haven't talked about it yet. And certainly it's had a huge impact on every industry and everyone. I'd love to hear from each one of you how the pandemic has impacted your businesses and your plans over the last 12 to 16 months.
I can start. Go ahead.
Oh, sure, Kristen. We'd love to start with you.
I'm just putting myself out there, I guess.
No, please.
I wasn't sure if you're going to call one of those. You know, the pandemic obviously has had an effect on each business, you know, one way or another. In our case, we do a lot for video remote interpreting, OPI, and telehealth. So we've seen actually a benefit, I hate to say, in growth revenue, because those services were so critically needed in many of our healthcare organizations, many of our government organizations, both domestically and abroad. But that being the case, and it's also shifted our business where we were traditionally doing a lot of over-the-phone interpreting, which is a lower cost solution to our clients, to a lot more of the telehealth and VRI, where they can have a better interaction with their patients or, you know, the people they're interacting with as they're being able to see them on you know, live like we're doing right now. So as an organization, we've had to make shifts and grow more strategically, more aggressively in areas that we hadn't necessarily thought was going to have that growth trajectory a year prior, which just has its own, you know, challenges. You know, whenever you have a market shift that's not on your current strategic roadmap, it takes obviously realigning resources and reallocation of priorities, which again is good and bad. And we've seen the same thing with our clients. Each one of our clients have had a different type of impact. I think the biggest impact, though, that we all share is how we've all been able to use technology to communicate in a more effective way. I think prior to the pandemic, we all use Zoom, we all use Teams or whatever platform we had. But, you know, we didn't necessarily have cameras on. We probably weren't as engaged with the technologies. And I feel like the you know, entire business world is much more engaged and utilizing technical, you know, platforms to be able to communicate more effectively than prior to the pandemic.
And Kristen, a little earlier, a minute ago, you mentioned perhaps reallocating to areas or reprioritizing certain areas that maybe you wouldn't have reprioritized pre-pandemic. What are one or two examples of those areas?
Sure. So, you know, as our company sits in many areas of service, so we do, again, content and we do interpretation and video remotes and telehealth. Our telehealth strategy was a little more planned out, hitting more in 2021-22. We had accelerated that growth opportunity that we had and put more resources and allocation of priorities into getting a better product out faster that could support our clients and also being more flexible in how we support them, as many of them were, you know, kind of butting up against this new normal themselves and maybe didn't have the appropriate, you know, systems and technology in place. So we ended up having to be a lot more focused on delivering in a mechanism that before we had had revenue and opportunity, but it was just accelerated at such a velocity that we had to adjust quickly to be able to support it.
There. Fardad, how has the pandemic impacted Kudo in terms of operations over the last 12 to 16 months?
So the pandemic had a huge impact pretty much on all businesses. Mm-hmm. And for majority of the business, there was a slow down of the business. We have been lucky to be on the part that really accelerated our business plans by about 2 years. So when March 1st of last year, when we were a team of 14 people at Kudo, when pandemic happened, we had this accelerated growth, accelerated user adoption. And we went from almost 3 million minutes usage per month to 3 million minutes usage per day within 3 weeks.
Yeah.
And we got to grow our team from 14 to 150 through video calls, no in-person interview. I haven't met more than 15, 20 people of our team. And this in-person meeting has happened in the last month and a half, right? So, what I can tell you is that a pandemic really changed how people do business forever, right? And there are a lot of old habits that we had that they were pretty much, I believe, some of them, they're gonna go away forever. I haven't had a phone call with my parents or my cousins or my family. Everything is now video. So video really became the de facto of communication. Mm-hmm. And my seven-year-old has opinion about what platform we should call my family, right? So
I hope she's imposing Kudo on you.
but when you think about it, also there is a little bit of a fear of missing out when it comes to the pace of work. Everything that is happening back to back every day, our schedules is a lot more packed with meetings, with calls. And even if you meet somebody in person, it's about what's next. You already have a couple of video calls scheduled after that, right? So I hope we can manage this better moving forward. But in regards to business itself, I think the customers' adoption to new technology, to the things that they've been, it's been available to them for quite some time, and they pretty much got to use those technology because of necessity, because they wanted really to stay in business, stay connected, and that has a long-term long-term impact on how we do business. But of course, going from in-person to online, whether it's in medical field, whether it's a legal, whether it's a business meetings, we didn't have a lot of time in planning, right? It was just happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. We're very fortunate that we have planning, time to plan to go from purely online to a hybrid. So that's really the next thing, how much we're going to plan for that next phase. But also, one thing that has happened in the last like 14, 16 months, the experience of these virtual online meetings, independent from what vertical, it has evolved, it has become so better, so powerful, mm-hmm. that some of those experiences are not going to be available when you're in person, right? And just the collaboration tools, being able to share, being able to add comments, annotate one another's comment, accessing files, you know, vote, all of that. But there are a lot of great things about in-person experience that could be still very attractive for the next phase of business meetings.
So, still talking about Kudo, JP, another effect that the pandemic had was to help us grow from 1,500 to 11,000 interpreters on our platform. These are vendors who actually work with us. And there's, of course, the happy side to that story, of course, having that kind of growth and being able to depend on such a large network of professional interpreters is great. But the sad part of that story is that those 11,000 interpreters actually went from having, say, sometimes six-figure income every year to zero. Mm. So interpreters were highly impacted. So, and of course, Kudo is in the interpretation business. So we were fortunate to have been prepared when the pandemic hit, but more so to have been in a position to extend a lifeline to the colleagues that now actually sustain Kudo and pretty much what we do, and to have been able to be there for them when the time came. So
that's great. Well, that sort of leads me to my next question is, and perhaps it's so basic, but yet so important for you, Evandro, you know, why is language so intrinsic to business, especially when there are multilingual characters involved?
Well, for many reasons. First off, it's a human right, right? You have the right to express yourself in your own language. Now, we think language is something that you're born with, right? But it's not. It's a human invention. It's something that props up here and there, depending on the circumstances, depending on your surroundings, depending on the geography around you. This is going to dictate how you refer to colors, how you refer to many things around you. And that goes into feelings and how you do business and how you communicate. And language becomes a very important and intrinsic trait when you want to reach out to anybody. And business is all about reaching out and tapping into other markets and actually talking to people at a level that's really close to their heart. Language is a huge enabler in that case, because without this element, you would never be really sure to be talking to, you know, coming across as you should, but to be talking to the right aspect of that person or community, right? We all have different personas when we speak different languages. Like, I'm expressing myself here in English to the best of my abilities, but I'm originally from Brazil. Now, when I jump on a call with somebody from Brazil and we get to speak Portuguese, I'm not just communicating more at ease, but I show a different personality. I show a different side, a different propension to doing business with you, I feel at home on a level that I would never feel if I'm just talking English, right? I have to set my mind to the English mode, to the French mode of speaking and doing business and so on. So language is behind the way we make decisions. It's behind how we think. It's behind everything.
You bring up language, and yet, you know, I feel like there's another, the other half of language, there's communication as well. And 80% of communication is, I think, body language, right? Which I feel like in the age of Zoom, in the age of, you know, Kudo and the rise of Kudo is body language. So much of communicating via video, body language is easily picked up. How do you feel like that is overcome or recognized in today's high-tech world?
Well, thank God we have video, like Fardad said, right? Video solves some of these problems, right? Again, when you talk about 80% being body language, it's actually nonverbal, right? There's a lot that goes into intonation, for example. You could be getting this, just the audio of what we're saying, and the intonation would actually convey a lot more meaning than the words that are actually coming out of my mouth. So there's intonation, there are the words. There's a researcher in California, Albert Mehrabian, who actually came up with a 7-38-55 ratio. 7% being the words, 38% being the intonation, and 55% being body language, right? The matter, the fact of the matter is that, again, when you see me, I can point to things and so on, and I can even make adjustments depending on what I know is your perception and your ability to see or not see certain aspects. If I tell you that this is blue, and there's an equivalent word in whatever language I'm communicating through to you, and I use that word, I'm betting on your ability to see this as blue. But if I know that you're colorblind, I'll try to come up with a different strategy that allows you to see it as I know you can. So this is also, again, these are aspects that go into communication. And again, interpreters are very well versed into these things. We tend to think of interpreters as, you know, 100% faithful. I say blue and then you say azul or whatever. But these things automatically creep into the conversation, and it changes the conversation just by virtue of having a mediator there.
Thanks, Evandro. Here's an additional question for each of you, Sean, Kristen, for Dodd. You know, as CEOs of your respective companies, you know, in the age of Zoom and Kudo and other video platforms, in the age of COVID-19, where our days are packed with video calls, I feel like, you know, we're staring into our cameras, and our faces and our bodies, communications are scrutinized to a higher degree. As leaders of your companies, how have you had to adjust the way you communicate and your language? How have you had to adjust that to your staffs and to your clients and vendors?
Before you go, guys, I can tell you this. Fardad is standing today. I walked past his office and he's standing. He has one of those tables that go up and down, and I'm very jealous, actually. So this is one way in which you adapt to how you communicate on video, right? He quickly realized that for this, he needed to be standing, right?
I couldn't tell, but he comports himself quite well, I must say, quite well. But maybe, Sean, we could start off with you.
Sure. It's an interesting topic in a sense of, I mean, other than the body language, but I think overall how it impacts your daily life and how you position yourself, from how you dress, from how you really program, you know, if you're a parent, how you would drop off your kids. Do you have to drop the kids off these days or not? Depends on what kind of world you live in. I think what it has done is the whole COVID situation. If it would happen 20 years ago, I can't imagine even how much devastation it would bring with itself. And because we didn't have many of the technologies we have today, and we have the privilege of using them. So to some extent, I think technology saved humanity, because we can all agree this is a global crisis. And every country is somehow dealing with it. And if it happened 20 years ago, I think the effect it would have on the economy of every country, that the effect it would have on the personal, psychological health of every human being, I think it would be immensely different. And I mm-hmm. think video platforms like Kudu and Zoom, they played a huge role into mitigating this. But I think as every technology that comes to solve a problem, that's probably how every startup starts, at least how every good startup starts, or the successful starts, is to really solve a problem. Later on, it starts getting, you know, wider adoptions, and it goes beyond the original solution that was intended to. And I mean, we all know samples. I'm not going to even really go over the samples, but I think what it's done, it has changed habits. Things that were not considered polite or were not considered even acceptable is now becoming normal. And I think this will go beyond COVID. Mm-hmm. I don't think we'll continue the virtual presence in offices. I believe many businesses, obviously, they can't be virtual. If you're working in a restaurant, you can't be a virtual waitress somewhere. But even the businesses that can do, I believe they will need a physical presence, because humans depend on social, physical interactions. You know, I personally, 2 weeks after I had my vaccine, and then my parents had their vaccines probably about like a 2 month before that. That was my first time that after over a year, I was able to hug my mom and my dad, right? And I'm like 40 something years old. And you can't imagine how much I missed that. And I never thought before that I literally hugged every, and I know it was still against the rules here. You still, even if you're vaccinated, you have to have, but I hugged them. Anybody I saw, they had vaccine 2 weeks past, I told them, I can't hold on. I really have to hug you. And I missed that. And I think a big part of why these virtual meetings and why these virtual interaction, especially internally in companies, work these days, is because there has been a social physical trust before the pandemic starts. So it is fantastic that companies like Kudo, it is amazing how fast they grow, and many of the people haven't physically meet each other. But I think at some point when this finishes, hopefully soon, I think it is critical for companies to keep that physical connection to some extent. But I think the advantage of COVID is that now we meeting virtually, I think even after COVID, is not rude. The fact that if we supposed to meet, and I recommend, instead of I fly to New York and then JP fly to New York and then Christian the same, we suggest, hey guys, how about we just do Zoom, and we're going to save a lot of fuel. We're going to save a lot of time, travel to airport. So instead of having this meeting in New York office, Kudo's New York office, that would literally, the fastest way would kill the entire day. Now it just takes 90 minutes, maybe 10 minutes before that and 10 minutes after that. So I think this is going to be normal. And I think that will change. That will change so many things. And I think that's the part that every company needs to really adapt themselves. I was talking as a speaker in UN Economic Forum, and that was a very interesting topic that was brought up. And most of the discussion was around this, and that what will happen after the COVID and how things were normal. So I think answering your question, JP, I think it will definitely change. And I think things that was not normal, was not acceptable, it will become more normal, and people will be much open to virtual meetings and virtual interaction as a substitute to the physical meeting.
You know, one thing too that I think is interesting has happened through COVID is prior to the pandemic, you know, we would have a lot of conference calls, but we weren't always having video on. And I think people just got used to video on. I know as a company, that was our policy, as we communicated with each other, so we could make sure that people were engaged in the conversations, that they were, you know, present, that we were communicating appropriately. And even, you know, with our client base, we just started doing a lot more with camera on. That was typically not as common in the past. It was more call based. And now all of a sudden, you know, we're seeing each other, even though we're not in a live meeting, which, you know, a lot of times meetings on site, so impactful. You're able to gauge, again, behavior. You're able to gauge communication. But this was an interesting kind of, you know, middle ground of you're not maybe having that, you know, on-site, in-person ability, but this is getting closer than, and certainly better than over the phone. And I think one of the things that I found interesting is during this time, you know, as we're all challenged with it, work-life balance was a little bit muddled. You know, your life was in your work was in your life. You're doing things from your kitchen counter, and you had kids in your background or dogs and whatnot. You got to humanize each other a bit through this. I mean, and I saw that even with some of our clients, where you got to know them in a very different way because you're in their living room with them, which was kind of an interesting thing. That was a positive thing in some ways, where we started to get to know each other more as humans, I think, through the pandemic. But, you know, I agree with Sean. There's a, to me, a leveling on this. You know, I think certain types of engagements, you know, a call is always going to be okay. Certain engagements, now we're going to be much more apt to using our Zoom so we can engage. Other engagements, we're going to want to be able to work in person. I think that there's a lot of value to being in the office together and being able to, you know, especially ideate and come together as either internally or with our clients. But I certainly think this whole interaction on camera with each other using Zoom or any, you know, technology that's out there, I think there's going to be wide utilization of it. It's going to be a lot more applicable and acceptable in scenarios that it wasn't prior to COVID.
Fardad, you're shaking your head. Do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think when you define CEOs, right, you're really looking at by default these fearless leaders that they're very ambitious and they really want to lead in a great company and hit all the milestones and all the plans that they have, and make sure we are at where we need to be. So, so what I want to just say to kind of echo what Kristen mentioned is really leading with empathy and making sure being able to get everybody on a video call at any time. We just not overdo it, right? We respect our team members, our clients. So we have kind of a quarterly all hands with, you know, objectives and what we want to do. And guess what our Q2 all hands, what's our objective? Reducing meetings by 20%. And that was our objective. And doing that, this would provide more time for everybody to think, to strategize, to go for a walk, you know, to help their spouse in parenting, preparing the food, and so on, right? The other thing is, when it comes to customers, it really be respectful of their time. And let's make sure we end the meetings on time. Let's say we ask for additional time if needed. Let's try to communicate more in writing, have agenda, have more asynchronous communication rather than synchronous communication, right? These are all the things that I think we should be very mindful. Otherwise, we're pretty much overdoing it by taking advantage of the tools that are available. And we're all ourselves, our partners, our team members. We are pretty much walking on a very fine line, right? Is it really work, personal? What time am I reaching out? Am I sending an email on a Saturday, 10 a.m., where I don't really need a response by Monday, right? Should I just respect the time and put it in my outbox and then hit the send button? So it's people, we don't add more stress, more sense of, oh, the on time, right? That sense of on time is very on these days, so.
Pradhan, I have to say that what you just said just made me laugh, because we're dealing with the same thing. We're, in a way, having these platforms, everyone just schedules time now too, and it's overscheduling, you know, and making sure that you're using it, like you said, even any platform that you're using, you come with an agenda, an objective, a time frame that you're holding to, because it's funny, we have the same objective, 20% reduction of meeting times to organization. Because you do have platforms, it's just easier to connect with people. There is some levels of challenge with that as well.
Well, I know we've skimmed upon technological solutions in different myriad ways and the ways we're using them, but I did want to talk about technology a little bit further. You know, we, particularly AI, you know, I feel like we could see AI used further, but we haven't seen it being deployed much yet. You know, why isn't AI being used more or further for interpretation? Is it a technological issue? Is it a neutrality issue or a legality issue? What if anything is holding AI from being further used in terms of interpretation? Maybe Evandro, if you could weigh in on that front.
Well, I guess part of it is we're all afraid of bomb threats, right? We don't want to get into it too soon, because we're already disrupting the market to a level that's very worrisome to most of the vendors out there, to the interpreters, right? Just pushing everybody out of the room. Now everybody has to connect through a computer and so on. Half of the constituents are up in arms. They didn't want it happen on their watch. They were happy with the way things were and so on. Now, but part of it, now being, you know, speaking more seriously, part of it is that the technology is not there yet. Still, we're doing, you know, speech to text, text to text, text to speech. You could actually argue that AI interpretation is feasible today as we speak. but it would be something that's not the same thing as hearing something and immediately going from speech to speech. So that's going to require a lot of investment, a lot of money, and some time. Now, with the amount of information that we have in platforms such as Skudo and others, where you have equivalent bits of speech in, say, Russian, and then on the other side, English and Spanish and Portuguese and whatnot, this is going to be the equivalent of what big data was for translation, where all of a sudden it became, you know, the translation, the machine translation devices started to get more and more apt. We're going to see that happen with speech interpretation as well. Now, to say that we're not using AI is an understatement, because we are. For example, in Kudo, we're now using AI not to replace the interpreters, but to aid the interpreters in better doing their job. Because of the nature of how we now interpret, I'm no longer in a booth where I have a colleague by my side. Mm-hmm. So I can't just, you know, look over my colleague and with a nod of the head, I know if I'm going in the right direction or not. That person is not making suggestions on a sheet of paper. So AI is replacing that. So Kudu is about to introduce a whole AI assist feature where if I'm interpreting along and I'm overusing a certain word, the machine is going to remind me, hey, you've been saying this too many times. So why don't you say that instead? It's going to help me with the units of measurement conversions. It's going to make suggestions on terminology that I'm probably getting wrong after, you know, listening to the speaker, contrasting with what is in the preparation materials, and so on. And a big part is also just allowing interpreters to prepare faster. So let's say you have 2 days, because this is another thing, right? Lead time is now a lot shorter for the interpreters. They have to jump into a meeting, say, in a few hours from now. So they may not have enough time to prepare. So AI is something we're using now to actually make quick sense of all the materials that are, you know, that have been provided by a client and extract important information, you know, based on the number of repetition words and so on, and trying to, you know, spell it out for the interpreter in a fraction of the time that it would take for them to prepare otherwise. So we're using AI in a way that makes sense. We don't think it's going to replace interpretation anytime soon, but eventually it may.
Eventually. So AI, to sum things up, AI is a valuable tool to augment and expedite the process for interpreters, but not necessarily to replace them in the short to medium term.
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. Thanks,
Evandra. I had a quick follow-up to that. I agree wholeheartedly. It's a step-by-step process. It really is. And we've seen that obviously on the translation side where AI has been utilized a lot longer and has been, you know, through neural machine translation and other MT, you know, traditional platforms. And it's step-by-step. And I think, you know, from my view and from what we're seeing in market with our clients, we look at utilizing those tools in a framework of evaluation of like, what's the risk? Is it low, medium, high risk content? And what is the user? Is it a high engagement, low engagement kind of use case? And from them, we apply AI based on, you know, that grid work. So an example would be if it's a low risk content and low use, meaning it has to be translated just for maybe, you know, they have to provide that content, but there's not going to be a lot of people that actually engage with the content or read it. You know, MT AI is utilized quite often in those cases now, and it should be. It provides an opportunity to be able to have a lot more content to market faster. Whereas if it's a, you know, low risk, but I know high readability, then we'll want to use maybe AI with a post editing or another service layered onto it where it's high risk. You know, you're going to want to make sure you're having a full translation and utilizing appropriate resources. And the interesting thing about it is I think there's been a fear whenever AI is in a conversation language industry. I think there's a fear of like the translator's work is going to go away and the interpreter's work is going to go away. And what we're finding is that there's just so much content that's being consumed globally, that it's not a lessening of use within the industry. We're still going to have use for interpreters or translators. It'll just be a little bit different than it used to be. But what we're seeing is massive amounts of content that we didn't have 20 years ago, you know, between social media and platforms and how we sell online and other things, where I think that fear has been abated. And I think people are embracing AI a lot more. AI in the interp space is obviously the newest frontier. You know, I think in the translation space, it's been, you know, focused for 10, 15 years. We've been using AI in some case. And it is a bit newer, but I see the same type of modeling of utilizing AI when you can in the right risk setting. Obviously, anything that has a high liability to it or a high risk, you know, you want to ensure that you're having best quality, which is the people business.
Yeah, Kristen, I totally agree. For example, today, as we speak, we could already be using some form of AI to say, interpret the demos that we run every day at Kudo. It's the same terminology, it's the same sequence, it's the same slide deck, and even the questions that are coming from the audience can be anticipated. So it's easy enough to train a machine to do that.
Right.
Now, it's a different thing to, you know, from there, think that we can go to the UN type of settings where people can quote poetry and they can use irony, and they half of what they're saying is an attempt not to say exactly how they feel about a subject. So there's a lot of diplomatic euphemism and so many other figures of speech and so on. So I was more talking about the overall concept of real conference interpreting, which is at the core of what we do.
Oh, yeah.
But I totally agree with you. Depending on how forgiving the setting is, this could already be something that we could resort to. It's like me. I remember once I was able to translate an article in a Finnish newspaper from Finnish into English without knowing one word of Finnish. It was an article about something I had written, and I was interested in seeing what their opinion was. I went to Google Translate, got the gist of it, and because I knew the subject, I was able to put it together. Now, if you can do this in a language that at least, again, the benefit of having something that allows you to get the gist of it, like when you go on a Chinese website and you translate it automatically, at least you know what they're talking about with the many mistakes that you will see. This is already something that, again, depending on how forgiving the setting is, could be of immense value. Yes, I agree.
And also, I think one thing in AI that I think is challenging, especially in like healthcare, where it's high liability anyway, so it's not a great use case for it, but also is the motive piece behind it. You know, they're emoting differently. It's not as prescriptive. The content isn't. So, you know, again, just supporting what you just said, it's also how prescriptive is the content? How prescriptive is the dialogue to be able to train a machine on both the subject matter and then, you know, the content you know will be utilized throughout. But I certainly think, I think we're all in agreement that there's going to be further development and further push of these technologies and solutions in market. And, you know, the market's ready for it. Again, we're just more global every day. And the more we can utilize tools to have that type of interaction where appropriate, I think is wonderful. And we're going that direction.
And I wanted to add something as well to the discussion. And I think that the artificial intelligence is currently very early in its life cycle. Like it's a couple of years really that is being really worked on, and it is out of just being a concept. And it is right now more focused on a specific vertical. So we use our artificial intelligence to do image processing. So the artificial intelligence is being used on specific tasks. Having said that, when we're talking, and the only company that I know is working on a wider range, basically OpenAI, and I believe Sam Altman is still the CEO there, and they are focusing on OpenAI, which means literally you want to have artificial intelligence. Because when we talk about intelligence of anything, intelligence is a result of full spectrum of experience that you gain in life. That's what gives you the intelligence. If you even raise a human and their only job from the day they're born is to just recognize images, they won't do a good job in background removal, for example.
Absolutely.
Because even if right now my job is to interpret something or is remove a background or tell you what is this disease from looking at the images. I was reading an article about Google just yesterday releasing an AI that would give you suggestion for skin diseases to high accuracy. I think the problem with the AI currently is that is very focused on a specific verticals, and that goes completely against the idea of intelligence. Because if I decide like what part of this image is the background and what part of it is the foreground, is not as a result of me repeating this process so many times. It is me as a result of living in a human in a society and understanding trees and understanding being walking in nature that has nothing to do with the background removal. But my overall intelligence, my overall experience, give me the decision of deciding if this pixel is part of the object or if this pixel is part of the background, which is one of the technology we're using. The reason I brought it up, because we're using AI to do background removal. We're using for image recognition in Glow3D. So I think we'll definitely get to that point. But I think we still have a relatively far distance, farther than you might imagine. I would say probably it's going to take at least 10 years to 20 years before humans are able to develop intelligence in a sense of multi-experience algorithm that can really repeat what a human goes through when they're analyzing things. You know, in so many instances, we make decisions and we think it is our gut or it is our feeling, it is our heart. But basically, all the gut decisions we make are a combination of unconscious decisions of the experience we had in the past, whether they are good or bad or successful or out of knowledge or just the success or losses we had in life will help us as, I don't feel good about this. That's our intelligence, really. That's what we combine unconsciously. We pull out from all those resources and without really being able to point at any of them, we feel that, well, this is not a right person to hire. This is not a right, you know, decision to make. So I think AI, we would probably have 10 to 20 years, but I think eventually I'm sure that AI will be able to take over most of the tasks that humans do and maybe things that require judgment because that the judgment will connect deep into human abilities. I think those will be the last for the computer to replace them. But everything else, I think we should all not to be naive and get ready for it as CEOs, as somebody who drives a truck or as somebody that is the CEO of a company, we should really have that vision to see where the future goes.
Now, I want to make sure that we open things up to questions from members of the audience. We have people in the audience tuning in from Dallas all the way to Rome. Please feel free to send in your questions and we'll do our best to get to them in a timely manner. In the meantime, I'll just sort of keep asking more questions. Maybe a question for you, Eduardo. You know, what type of multilingual tech can be employed by startups and the enterprise currently?
Well, I guess before I go there, let me just agree totally with Sean on what he said and very eloquently. We tend to think of AI as intelligence, right? But it's actually pattern recognition and probability control. That's all it is. When it goes into judgment, then we get lost, as you said, and language is all about judgment, right? Especially translation. It's all about making decisions and it's all about judgment. Again, I don't think that any startup would survive these days without technology, right? Again, from the basic stuff like video connectivity, having connectivity. By the way, Eduardo just asked a question on the chat here that I attempted to answer in writing. Will connectivity even become a human right in the future? Not having connectivity, will that equate to a huge and deep form of exclusion? I believe so. And we already have people working on making sure that that's not the case. So again, a startup would not survive today without connectivity, without technology and so on. If we're talking about language, there are many things because every question, every answer, I'm sorry, brings about new questions, right? So if you solve the issue of interpretation like we have, for example, what do you do about the chat? Right, okay, we're in a meeting like this and people in Rome would rather ask a question in Italian, have it translated correctly into English so that I can instead answer in Portuguese and get that across in my own language. So again, we'll need to grow into these kinds of niche solutions as we go. But at the core of it, there will be a lot of translation, a lot of localization tools that we'll have to contemplate as we go. The examples would be too many to name them here without making it boring. But I'll leave it at a very generic level at this point.
Fair enough. Then to switch gears, maybe we can talk about, you know, each of your companies are sort of at different, shall we say, sizes and different stages of the lifespan of a startup. How can companies of different sizes tackle the challenge of multi-language clients? Maybe, Kristen, we can start with you.
You're muted, Kristen. We don't hear you.
Sorry, I think I went out and came back in, so I apologize about that. Could you repeat the question, JP?
No worries. I was basically saying, each of your companies are probably at different stages of the lifespan of a startup. How can companies of different sizes tackle the challenge of multi-language clients?
I think I see that a lot with our clients, where we deal with anything from small startups to mid-level to, you know, large, you know, global enterprises. And, at each stage, there's a challenge. It's never just like, you know, you get to international company and now you've got it down. Like, they each have their own set of challenges. And when I think about startups and I think about kind of that mid-level, for me, it's always ensuring that you have an ROI on where you're going and how you're going to get there. So you're investing in the right thing at the right time and using technologies when you can, those use cases where it's good enough, using MT, using some of these other technologies so you can deploy quicker. Also, one thing that we've worked a lot with our clients on is ensuring that the content that they're using is structured correctly, so it has a less expensive cost to translating, that is translated more quickly, it can be leveraged in different use cases, so you don't have to retranslate content a lot and put a lot of, you know, costs into that bucket. But it really, you know, goes back to, what are you trying to achieve and what is your strategy and what's that investment look like? Because it depends on product and vertical and sizing, right? But that you're thoughtful about that and aligning the cost model to it quickly. What we see a lot is translation interpretation is an afterthought. We have a product in market, now we need to do this. We now have a client that we need to serve, so we now need an interpreter. And making sure as you're thinking about going global, the cost of the impact of that, again, not just getting product to market, but then servicing post and ensuring that you have a cost modeling around it, I think is critical.
For Dodd, for you, from your perspective, how can companies of different sizes tackle the challenge of multi-language clients?
I definitely make sure to answer this, but I want to just express how excited I am after listening to Sean about 10 to 20 years. I can't wait to have a mini CEO AI version of me that I can help. I'm not giving up. In regards to different stages, I think it's really about the how much the company is engaged from early on in the whole multilingual and global market. So I think going back again to AI and the large investment within the AI space for translation, including companies such as Google, Microsoft, Facebook. You'd be surprised that even after 10, 15 years of billions of dollars of investment, they're still relying on translation agencies to really prep them for launching a product in different markets and not their own product. So that tells about, even at that stage of the company, you still need to be fully engaged, even though you have your own tech stack to tackle that, to really understand multilingual aspect and connect truly. So that's, to me, I don't see the challenges are different. It's all really about the scope and the volume and really how integrated the company is within the global user base.
Mm-hmm. Got it. In terms of looking forward, I mean, what are your forward, how much of your forward-looking strategies have been affected by the pandemic? Can you talk a little bit about that? Maybe for Dodd, if you wanted to start us off.
What we all have in common as entrepreneurs and CEOs is really how wrong we are in predicting whatever it takes to launch a product, to acquire a customer, to basically we're very optimistic people, right? And always underestimate whatever it takes to get the business from point A to point B. This is a very common thing specifically for startups. So this was the first time I was proven wrong. The pandemic really put us ahead of our schedules by 2 years. And now, of course, when you are in a very fast space, hot space, kind of a field that increases the ambitious and the plans and the things that you want to do, because everybody is paying attention in that area. So there's a lot of smart people, resources that are looking at this space and looking at this. So really being able to constantly create a new kind of areas to be ahead, that's something that we need to do to stay relevant for midterm and long term. So that is definitely pandemic empowered us to have the resources to do that, but also at the same time putting us in a spot that delivering these ideas and these promises need to happen very quickly and properly.
Thanks, Fardad. Now we have a question from Imal Gamshirik, who asks, how do you avoid bleeding cash into automated localization of content customers don't need? Is there a need to maximize work not done? Is there anyone on the panel who would like to jump in and answer that question? Whether perhaps Kristen, perhaps Sean?
It's for you to maximize work not done. I'm sorry, I'm trying to understand the question. So how do you avoid bleeding cash into automated L10 of content customers don't use? I guess I'm not clear what the question is. I'm sorry.
I didn't understand the question.
No worries.
Yeah, sorry.
Well, no worries. Well, Imal, if you're still tuning in, if you want to clarify your question, please do so. We'll be happy to answer it.
JP, I spent some time looking at the question before. Again, yeah. I think it's like for everything else, it's a whole lot of market research, right? It's okay. Not just, it doesn't go just for localization that people don't need. It goes for anything else that clients don't need. So the way to address this is to have the right features in place to make sure that you're communicating correctly with your client to the extent needed to actually know what they need. And language is already a big part of that. So the first effort is to have localization geared at allowing you to have that bridge at least in place so that you can already know and gather and compile from the exchange the actual needs of your clients. So I'll leave it at that. That's the best I can do with the limited understanding that I have of the question.
Well, one other thing I was going to say is I was wondering if this was in the framework of utilizing technologies to, you know, auto-translate content that's maybe part of websites and that type of thing. And in that case, what we're seeing is there's been a lot of, I think, redesign in the last 5 years of our clients' technical tech decks and or tech stacks and technologies that they're utilizing to ensure that they're structuring their content in a way that they're only really working with valuable content. And there's just, I think, been a huge effort, you know, with structured content over the last 10, 15 years, but even more so when it comes to localized content over the last five that we've been seeing. But making sure it's structured well will certainly eliminate costs of translated content that's not necessary.
Great. Well, if anyone has any other further questions, please feel free to send them in and we'll just continue chatting. Kristen, can you talk about your forward-looking strategy as we, hopefully as the globe, reemerges from the pandemic, and how much of it has been impacted by the pandemic and how much of it hasn't?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really hasn't changed our strategy so much. It just accelerated our strategy in certain areas, which, in some cases cause a reprioritization or lowering prioritization of other, strategic areas we were focused on. But it really hasn't changed. Again, we really had to refocus and re-strategize around telehealth, video remote interpreting, those solutions, and make sure we're able to deliver and have extensible technologies that implement it. It also accelerated our strategy around some of the AI technologies that we're creating more around health outcomes and non-English speakers in the U.S. market. But those were already on our strategy playbook. It was just, maybe accelerating and bringing them in a little bit sooner and funding it sooner.
Got it. For you, Sean, with Glow 3D, as you move forward and reemerge out of this unprecedented situation, has your forward-looking strategy been impacted in any way?
Yeah, significantly, actually. The way the COVID impacted our business is that many online sellers or e-commerce platform would, before the pandemic, they would see us as a nice to have tool, a cool tool that would help them interact. So, and it wasn't necessarily solving the problem. They would using 2D photos and videos that were happy with them and they had all their projections meet and everything was good. And when the pandemic came in, our technology became a necessity, something to create a difference from the competition, and it became a necessity. So we got calls from many e-commerce platform, even famous ones that we demoed like 6 months before the pandemic, and that was their answers. I mean, it's really cool that you guys do this, but now we don't see any need. And they reached out to us and say, hey, remember you guys did a 5 months ago, you guys did a demo. How about let's talk about it. We want to really kind of, invest more in our online, business side of things. And so that's what changed for us. And it was very big. It helped us to go from a startup with having a nice idea to a startup that would solve a problem for a new online world. So to some extent, it helped us quite a bit that everything went online. And we think to a very extensive side, at least on a product side, on an online business, this will be a trend that probably adjusts a little bit, but we think it will be towards upside because many people that would see an offline shopping as a sort of an option and they were used to it. And they were doing it not necessarily because it was easier to do offline shopping. It was just that they're used to it, right? And they were forced to try online shopping from the grocery store to the product. And once they were forced to do this for almost a year now, I think that establishes new habits. When you ask, like either force people, but of some sort of reason, you make people repeat something for a very long time, like what we have been all exposed for the past year, it starts establish habits. And I think these habits will definitely go beyond the COVID. And I think many people will continue shopping online where they did not do that before pandemic. So to that extent, our entire startup, and because we were relatively a small size, Our entire startup was sort of changed because of that.
Got it. Now, as we wind things down, many of the people in our audience, you provided a trove of advice and insights to our audience. But if you could give, if each one of you could give one last parting piece of advice to the audience as experienced leaders, as CEOs and executives of your respective companies, for their own respective businesses, I think they would very much appreciate that, in terms of leading and expanding their companies globally. That would be great. For Dodd, what sort of parting piece of advice would you offer to the audience in terms of globalizing their business?
It is much easier than you think, right, to start expanding globally. And by trying to really work with people with the expertise. So I would say, because of the technology, because of the content, because of the know-how and experiences and lessons learned that are already out there, going global could happen much quicker, much easier, with a lot of ROI, more than what people have imagined before. So my two cents for other executives is don't underestimate how valuable this would be for your business, for your success, short term and long term.
Thanks, Wardad. Evandro, do you have any parting words of advice?
I'm very opinionated, so when you ask me for opinions, I usually have many. But I guess, again, I'll go back to what I know best, which is language, right? And especially a word for the vendors out there, right? Which is a huge subset of our clients, right? Because we have clients out there as clients, and we have our interpreters also as clients. We provide them with platforms, with the platform and the Kudu Marketplace now, which is a whole new world for them to expand their businesses and so on. I will give them the advice that I always give anybody who approaches me privately. Keep an open mind. Keep an open mind, because you see a lot of push and pull. You see a lot of bad advice out there telling people to stand their ground and to wait because this is going to go and so on. And that's not going anywhere. If anything, we're going to go into a hybrid future where what we do and how we've been doing this for now will continue to be a sizable portion of the market and how we do business and how we interpret. If the world eventually comes back to being what it actually was before, you lose nothing by learning a few more tools and a few more strategies that you can apply during the hard times. So I would say hop on Kudu at the earliest possible opportunity, and let's continue to build this future together, but keep an open mind.
Thanks, Evandro. Kristen, any last parting piece of advice?
Yeah, I think, for me, when I think about going global and other people that are considering it, I think strategizing and creating a plan against ROI are so critical, but it's only as good as the success, of your deliverable and what you're actually able to bring to market. So no one should be locked in to it, meaning that they should frequently assess their strategy and how well it's going against milestones, and be ready to be adaptable, be ready to pivot, be ready to think differently about technology and solutions that may make things easier or may change, the trajectory of your plan. But I think always being ready to be adaptable is critical to be successful and trying to grow global business.
Thanks, Kristen. And Sean, certainly not last but not least, any parting words of advice?
I think the future of technology is very, very at the very beginning in terms of AI and VR and AR and so many cryptocurrencies and the crypto blockchain technology in general. Are different parts of, I would see it as a body that is moving technology forward. But I think what would probably act more as a brain is AI, artificial intelligence, that is definitely going to impact every business, at least in my opinion. I think regardless of if you're a judge or if you're a truck driver or if you are an architect, I think AI will definitely in future impact any business. And I think at CEOs of companies as business owners. You don't have to be a CEO. You could be a truck driver, and you could understand that and think about how AI is going to impact your business, and trying to be forward with that, and trying to be thinking about how it's going to impact your business. Do you have to pivot? Do you have to change that? And I always say, if at the time that the refrigerator was invented, and people used to go to frozen lakes and cut the ice and bring it back, and those companies wouldn't really boycott them, trying to stop refrigeration companies and their technology and trying to somehow damage them, they could become part of it. That's something that I think future will be. So I think AI would be something that it will impact every business. And I think the way it would start impacting would be probably things that are more task oriented would definitely be replaced at the beginning. And then things that are more about requirement of judgment, then those will be probably in the next line. And then at the end, we'll have vision. So in my opinion, AI will never replace vision, at least humanity's vision for things. And that's a good thing for CEOs. The good news for CEOs that I was watching something from Simon Sinek the other day, and it was interesting that he was saying the CEOs should probably change to CVOs because they are chief vision officers, and their main goal is to really see the vision of the organization they are really leading. And I think vision of the future of any organizations or any country or the planet in all is something that I don't think AI will never replace that. But good luck to everyone. Thank you so much for having me, this panel. And it was a pleasure to meeting everybody else here.
Thanks so much, Sean. And thank you so much, Fardad, Evandro, Kristen. I really appreciate all of you being here, and I really loved hearing your perspectives. And I hope all of you who are watching out there took away some valuable learnings. For those who want to revisit moments from today's webinar, a recording will be made available on Multilingual's website at a later date. Thank you to our fantastic panelists. Thank you to everyone for attending. And thanks for everyone at Multilingual for making today's conversation possible. Goodbye, and have a lovely day. Okay.